Welcome to the Class of 1987 podcast. I am your host, Tim Harkness. On this podcast, we will be speaking with members of the Yale College Class of 1987 about their lives, where they've been, where they are now, and where they are going. We plan to cover a wide range of topics and have people who represent the full range of our class's experience. The class of 1987 is the best class that Yale College has ever had, and we're here to celebrate that. So sit back and listen to what your classmates have to say. And welcome to this edition of the Y87 podcast. With me today is Morgan Grove. Hi, Morgan. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I am good. I am in sunny Connecticut today. Thankfully, it's sunny. We still have some leaves on the trees. Where are you?
I'm in Silver Spring, Maryland, though I work in Baltimore, but haven't been in the office for almost a year and a half.
Wow. So tell me, what are you up to these days?
Well, I continue to work for the USDA Forest Service. I've been with them for 25 and a half years. So I got actually hired by the Forest Service coming directly out of finishing up my PhD program at Yale.
Terrific. And what kind of stuff do you do at the USDA?
So I'm a research scientist, and that means that basically I end up writing those 15-page papers that we had to do as undergrads, but now other people also have to read them. And I conduct research on urban sustainability and resilience with particular attention to the role that trees and natural vegetation in cities play in making cities better places to live, and also how they may play a critical role in us adapting to climate change into the future. I spent a lot of time working with practitioners in government agencies at the federal, state, and local levels. I work with businesses and nonprofit organizations to understand what their information needs are, to conduct research, and to put into formats that are useful for them to make decisions.
Interesting. How'd you get into trees? Like, why trees?
I've always loved trees. I think that...
Just so the record's clear, I'm not anti-tree. I'm just sort of curious. Like,
yeah.
How do you get into trees?
Well, you know, my family, like my grandparents, my parents, always loved being outdoors. And I grew up in a small college town, Swarthmore, where all the streets are either named after trees or named after colleges. So, you know, there's this like deep subliminal messaging that was probably going on. Plus, where our house was, you would walk out the back of my house and you would actually walk through the woods. You could walk through the woods to go to elementary school. Like, I didn't actually have to walk on the street to go to school. And we spent all of our time in the woods, you know, and this woods, which seemed fantastically large, was probably maybe like 2 acres. But we just lived there. And, you know, during the summer, the moms would let us out at 8 a.m. and we didn't have to be home until 7. And we were just left to our own devices, which seems so primitive and anti-helicopter parenting compared to probably how kids exist today. And so I loved just being outdoors, and it was sort of normal and expected. And when I got to Yale College, they had just started a second double major called Studies in the Environment, which now is its own full major and is environmental studies. And I double majored in architecture and environmental studies in the environment. You know, always in our architecture projects, particularly if it required a site plan, they would always say to me, you know, much less detail about the trees, more attention to the buildings. And
so you've sort of rejected that and gone the other way.
I was struggling with that. And, you know, my goal was back in the day, it seemed crazy talk. Now it's common, is that I wanted to do architecture. And I thought that we should really understand how buildings fit into the landscape and how the landscape could inform the buildings. And that was sort of heresy within architecture, like they were going to get rid of me. And so I thought, well, I'll go get an ecology degree, and then I'll get a landscape architecture degree, and then I'll go be a designer. And so I went to the Yale School, what's now the Yale School of the Environment, had been the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, went there and really loved doing the ecology and what we call community forestry, which is the linkage between community and forestry and community development. And I love that. During those summers, I was working at Caesar Pelling & Associates, which was an architecture firm and still is an architecture firm in New Haven. And, you know, two things, one of which was I got asked to go up to that place up in Cambridge and sit in on one of their review crits for their graduate school of design, landscape architects. These were third-year students. I really realized that they didn't really know anything after 3 years of grad school in terms of the environment. And I was like, this is distressing. I don't know if I want to go become a landscape architect. And then I was working in this architecture firm, and I realized that I really didn't like any of the architects. And I was like, well, why do I want to be, you know, have a profession in this if I don't really like anybody, you know, working actually, in this?
Probably wise. Like,
you know. Yeah. So I started to reconsider that. And during that time in my master's, my advisor said to me, hey, why don't you go down to Baltimore? And there's an interest in trying to understand how a graduate program like Yale's could contribute to addressing environmental concerns and linking it to community development, urban revitalization. So I got shipped down there and spent the summer and loved it. And I was like, this is it for me. And my parents, who had been in the second class of the Peace Corps, they're like, you're just doing Peace Corps, but you're in the United States. And I said, yeah, well, you know, I guess I'm just following my parents' footsteps. And I loved it and was doing that. I finished my master's and I wanted to keep doing it. But the money had run out. But then, you know, the powers that be said, well, you know, if you get into a PhD program, well, you can keep doing this and we'll pay you to be a doctoral student. And so I was like, okay, I don't really want a PhD, but that sounds like a good deal to me. And so I did that and finished a PhD.
Can we just pause on that for a second? So when you're doing the PhD, from what you've just described, there were no academic lanes that were clearly defined. So did you have to design your own program?
I completely had to design my own program. And it's really remarkable that you mentioned this because, so I do my PhD and the last qualifying exam question was, now that you have completed this degree in urban ecology, who will hire you? And I was like, you jerks. Like, you just made me study for 4 years and you think that I have pursued a professional dead end. And my advisor said, well, that's all very well and fine, but as soon as you sign that document, he already has a job offer with the Forest Service to lead a program in interdisciplinary science and urban ecology. So just sign here and let him go.
let Morgan, Dr. Grove go. That is exactly terrific.
And so I walked out of my qualifying exams on June 15th, 1996, and I had 3 days off, and I started with the USDA Forest Service on June 18th, 1996, and I've worked for them for, like I said, 25 and a half years. And in doing so, I mean, it's crazy. And like, remember, I said I wasn't really interested in doing a PhD. I ended up leading this whole science program for the Forest Service. I've written 2 books. I have written 150 journal articles and have been cited 19,000 times. Like, I feel like the most accidental scientist in the world.
Doesn't sound too accidental to me.
No, so, but it's been a blast.
That sounds like it. Sounds like it. Now, I was intrigued with a few things you've said. So let me ask a couple follow-up questions first. You mentioned that you really interact with businesses. So I never think of the U.S. Forestry Service as doing that. Like, what are the interests businesses have in what you're talking about?
In urban areas, some of the key ones are with environmental consulting firms and engineering firms. So like AECOM is huge. Parsons Brinckerhoff, all these firms that are trying to, not just the landscape architects, but everyone who's working in green infrastructure, stormwater management, green roofs, urban agriculture. One of the big projects that I actually have is in urban wood. And there's more wood.
What is urban wood?
Urban wood.
It sounds like a band.
Oh, Sandy Smallins wouldn't agree.
All right.
Yeah. So there's a lot of wood that comes from building demolition or building deconstruction. The second is all the trees in your town or city, when they die or there's a major storm, that wood has to go somewhere. Right. And there's actually more wood that comes out of urban areas that goes into landfills than is harvested from the national forests.
Really?
that gives you a sense of the magnitude of the amount of wood. Now, my colleagues in the National Forest System would say that's because we don't harvest enough. That's for a different day conversation. So there's a huge amount of wood. It's often unique species. It was often slow growing. And so it's of high quality. And I was tasked, and this is sort of how my career goes. I was assigned, well, leadership Forest Service comes to me and says, okay, Morgan, here's the study plan. Urban wood, figure it out.
Ready, go.
Yeah, a lot of my study plans are X, figure it out. And we ended up doing a lot of work on row homes that were being deconstructed in Baltimore. It's workers, low-income workers' homes that were built primarily the interiors with old growth southern yellow pine, which as a lumber species doesn't exist in the world anymore. It was old growth yellow pine. So when it was cut down, it was maybe 400 or 500 years old in the late 1800s and early 1900s. So it's really close grain wood and it is beautiful. And so we have that. And then we also are working with the what we call fresh cut, which is the trees that are cut down, and working to develop urban wood industries. And we were doing this in partnership with a nonprofit that was working to reduce rates of recidivism and to create jobs for people who are returning citizens from prison or have suffered from drug abuse. And this was their first job.
So you combine that sort of like a social policy mission with people, but also to save the wood.
Right. So it's sort of this trifecta of bringing together social, economic, and environmental things all together. And so this was going pretty well, but we realized that we needed to create more value downstream in order to create more jobs upstream. And so we ended up stalking one of the vendors at Room and Board, persons who's in charge of vendor management. We stalked them on LinkedIn, and I ended up having to give sort of this Shark Tank pitch. I had 20 minutes to the main people at Room and Board, and they loved it. And they said, okay, well, this was in April. They're like, we'll come out in May. Came out in May, and they had an urban wood line of furniture by December of 2017.
Is this something that people can go out and buy right now?
Yep, absolutely. So, but it's expanded, and that was our goal, was to expand beyond Baltimore. So now they're acquiring wood from Sacramento, from Detroit, from Southern California, and they really see the future because they're based in the United States. They get material from the United States that they could sort of shift their entire furniture lines from wood only from, you know, from urban settings. And this wood otherwise would end up in the landfill and be a carbon, it'd be sort of a carbon deficit. It'd be bad for the environment. But it's getting locked up in your house, right? You know, so you're actually contributing to carbon storage through this activity. So it's actually a climate thing as well as being a sustainability thing. That's an example of working with the private sector that is really terrific. And the Forest Service has always worked, you know, in terms of wood products as being a major player in anything that, you know, involves wood, from this example to nanotechnologies for carbon fiber to cross-laminated timber for 18-story buildings made out of wood. So I get to hang with them. That's really fun.
That sounds interesting. So let me ask you this. If you're talking to our classmates, you have 2 minutes to say, here's what you need to worry about for sustainability, because most of us live in and around cities.
Right.
What should classmates be thinking about?
Reuse as much of the stuff that you have, buy an electric car, plant trees, and be very scared.
Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you're enjoying the conversation. Please remember that this podcast is being brought to you by the 35th reunion of the greatest class Yale College has ever known, the great class of 1987. Our reunion will be in New Haven, Connecticut, June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th in Pearson College. We hope to see you there. Now, back to the conversation.
Very scared. That's really ominous. So what should we be most scared about?
Well, I think, you know, the framing to this would be you're on a jet. You're on a 757. and you're flying and you hit this really bad storm. Like, I've been on these flights and you're dropping, you know, coming back from China, and you're dropping 10,000 feet and it is scary as hell. And the steward or the stewardess says, don't worry about it. The plane's designed for this. Right. And so you're like, okay, I'm not designed for this, but so be it. Like, we're going to make it. And what we're entering is a climate and economic systems and governance systems that are not designed for climate change. And so it's like the captain and the stewardess getting on and saying, we're entering this really bad storm, and this plane isn't designed for it. That is what I mean by very scary. Like, our political systems, our economic systems, our social systems are not designed for these kinds of disasters. Our insurance systems are not designed for this. The mass migrations that we have already experienced and will experience much more are not designed for this. So there's a lot of the green growy stuff, like I mentioned, in terms of the electric car, plant trees.
But doesn't sound like that in and of itself is enough.
No, I think that we need to think about wherever we are, you know, however we're positioned within the matrix of political systems and economic systems, what can we do to think about how we adapt? And historically, and you see it at Yale College, right? You have majors, which are basically the silos of society, right? And you have government agencies, which are the silos of society. And the way that we're adapting is, and we're kidding ourselves, is we're going to move the silos a little bit closer. Or we're going to allow double majors, rather than thinking about, well, how do we actually take a networked approach where we understand the interconnections? And so if you're in, you know, you're working in business, or you're working in government, or you're working with an NGO, is to think not only about what you do, but how it connects with others and how to collaborate, how to build teams to take on these challenges with the knowledge that we're entering into a period that will be most pronounced over the next 30 years of great uncertainty, right? So we used to think, oh, we live in a pretty predictable environment, and if we could just figure out how we could do things better, we could be more sustainable. Well, the idea of sustainability with 10 years ago, 20 years ago as a reference, like, that's gone. We need to focus more on how do we adapt with a goal of being somehow sustainable, but we don't know what that environment is. When I say environment here, I mean social, economic, and biological.
So you're talking about, when you're talking about adaptation, I assume you're talking about adapting our cities in particular, because that's where you have such population density, to withstand storms, to deal with rising tides, to deal with that kind of thing. Are you also talking about moving people, just going north? Is it that simple?
Well, the trees have already started. I mean, we know from our data that the species are always shifting north. I don't know if it's a massive northern movement.
Or southern, I guess, if you're in the southern hemisphere, but yeah.
Right, exactly. But if you, a couple things that we know, that the major source of death will be due to heat waves. I mean, that's, we know that. So how can people adapt to extreme heat? People who live in very hot areas where there's limited amount of water, you know, I don't know what the prospects are. One of the most expensive things to do is to move water.
Right, right.
It is just expensive to move water. It is heavy. and you can't charge much for it. So I think that if you, you know, the United States is really distinct. And Stegner wrote, you know, crossing the 100th meridian, as soon as you move west of the 100th meridian, which is, you know, somewhere in the Midwest, there's just a lot less water. Right?
Yeah, we're seeing that with Lake Mead, the yep. Hoover Dam. I mean, it's impossible to ignore.
Yeah, it's going to be the absence of water and the excess of heat that are going to be the main drivers of things.
Hmm.
Right? And so we do have catastrophic storms with wind and with flooding. That is a little bit easier to adapt to. And so you may have localized migration versus extreme heat and the absence of water and then fire that can be associated with that. You know, what we know from the Forest Service is that we're seeing fires that we've never seen before in our lives. And they're creating their own weather patterns.
Right, right.
Right. And most of the tools that we use for fighting forest fires depended upon small forest fires that were predictable. Now we have massive forest fires that are unpredictable. So we build forest fire lines to prevent the movement of fire, but then the fire just skips over those lines.
Right. And it's interesting. We have one of our sons did what was supposed to be a 400-mile canoe trip through the Boundary Waters this summer, and because of forest fires, turned out to be a 500-mile canoe trip through the Boundary Waters. But the fires, to your point, had completely changed the weather. And so he packed for the weather that we've had in the Boundary Waters for hundreds of years, since the beginning of records of these things. And that's not at all what he encountered. So, you know, that adaptation is happening in real time. So let me ask you this. What should our classmates be reading, listening to, thinking about? I know that, you know, I looked at, there was a recent UN report that aggregated a lot of the studies you're talking about. But how do people become responsible consumers of information so they can action it?
Wow. I wish I hadn't asked that question. I've never thought about that. I really don't know. I guess because I'm so immersed in it day to day that I've never stepped outside of it.
Yeah, and I have to say, as a layperson, what I struggle with is, and maybe because I'm just such a nerd, I'd like to go to the source documents. So every once in a while I do, like with that UN report. But reading a lot of the popular press about the issues you talked about, some of it sounds like sort of breathless and alarmist in a way that I, even if I buy the idea of everything you're saying, like it's still vague, that it's hard to understand what can I do that's really going to matter. And that's what I struggle with.
Yeah, I think, so the new IPCC report is going to come out in November.
IPCC is?
Intergovernmental.
Some policy thing. I got it.
Climate change at the UN. You know, they're going to describe how things are bad and how we need to do a whole bunch of things. And that doesn't contemplate, like, what happens if the Greenland ice sheet breaks off and we have sea level rise of 7 feet in 10 years. Like, it doesn't contemplate that very likely thing in the Atlantic, right? I think that what I would do is I would sort of take the IPCC report and I would try to understand wherever I lived, what documents does my state and my city or my town have that is contemplating how they're going to adapt. Or, you know, or the absence of how they're going to adapt.
Yeah. Are they going to even try to adapt? I think there's some governments that don't. I mean, my town does, but I look at even some of the flood maps.
Right.
Like, they're badly outdated. You can tell they're not right.
They're not right in terms of coastal flooding. They're also not right in terms of, like, you may not live close to any flood zone, but the design standards for controlling stormwater are set for a 10-year storm in 1 hour, right? The design standards, but what we're facing, we had a storm where we had a 1,000-year storm in 30 minutes. It exceeded the design standards for wherever you live because the design standards are made and adopted. I mean, the word is standards, right? So everyone has them. And so, for instance, the built-in inertia of our infrastructure is not at all adapted, you know, just how do we build stormwater systems, stormwater management systems, is completely antiquated. But then if you said to me, okay, well, what should be the new standard? If I was honest, I would say, we really don't know because we're seeing a 1,000-year storm in 30 minutes and there's no place for the water to go except for your basement. Right? Or to sweep away your cars.
Yeah, if you're lucky, because I think I know what storm you're talking about. And we had that storm was preceded only a couple weeks before it was a record-setting storm. So we had two record-setting storms within two weeks. And people died, literally drowned in the street.
Yeah, so that was Hurricane Ida. And then, you know, going back to your earlier question, there's an organization called the Urban Sustainability Directors Network, or USDN. And I think that they have some of the best information that of a general use that you could have. I think that if you're working in the private sector or government or whatever, is to say, you know, wherever you're working, if you're working, is to say, well, what's my company's policy on this as well? And what are we doing? And, you know, and I think one of the things that I've been doing a lot of work on too is looking at the phenomenon of B corporations or benefit corporations, and looking at, you know, what they're trying to achieve, and then saying, okay, well, how well does wherever I work, how well does it match up to what are the standards that they're establishing?
I got it. So we're almost at the end of our time together, and I always wrap these things up with a lightning round.
Okay.
Of quick answer questions.
Yes.
Are you ready?
42.
Perfect. Okay, number one, if you were to be any tree, what tree would you be?
American chestnut.
Why?
Because it was the biggest tree in the forest before it was wiped out, but it's coming back. And it also was great for furniture. It was used for making charcoal. It fed so many different animals within the forest. It just was the benevolent giant of the forest.
If there was one forest our classmates should visit in the next year, what should it be?
I love the Blue Ridge Mountains. I would head to Asheville and just spend the week.
Is there a forest in the world where you haven't been that you still want to go to?
Oh, the Amazon.
All right.
Or you got to go like the old growth forests of Siberia. Just are pretty amazing. And they're beautiful and they haven't been touched because it's so miserable there, but it's pretty amazing.
Sounds good. Now, is there a food from New Haven that you miss?
Pizza.
Which, are you a Sally's or a Pepe's or Modern?
I was a Sally's person. When I was in grad school, I lived in Worcester Square, and a buddy of mine was really good friends with Sally's, and he had a standing reservation every Thursday evening, and we could just bypass the line, and we had a table waiting for us.
Wow, that person has arrived. That's great. Okay, one last pizza question. The New Haven place called Bar puts mashed potatoes on their pizza. It's mashed potatoes, bacon. Are mashed potatoes on a pizza an abomination or an innovation that is really critical to understanding pizza?
I don't know if abomination, but it just makes no sense, because one of the beautiful things about New Haven pizza is how thin it is and how you can taste all the ingredients. And just the phrase mashed means that all those flavors are smushed together and you can't taste them distinctly. So I think mashed potatoes just doesn't get New Haven pizza.
Fair enough. Well, thank you again for taking the time to speak. And it's been great. Learned a lot.
It's really fun to see you. I miss you. I'd give you a hug if we were in the same place.
I miss you too. All right. Thanks.
You got it. I'll talk to you later.
In a world where people were isolated by a pandemic, forced to live their lives remotely in an endless parade of Zoom meetings, one Yale College class dared to break the mold. The Yale College class of 1987 is planning what no Yale College class has ever tried before, at least not for a while. An in-person reunion, June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th, 2022, we will be gathering in Pearson College. Be there for engaging discussions, nightly revelry, and way too much New Haven pizza, if there ever could be such a thing. We'll wrestle with age-old questions like, maybe I look better in a mask, what do you think? Who or what is a Bula? What in the world am I going to do with no kids in the house? These questions and more will be answered at our 35th college reunion. Be there. That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.p. harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you.